The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening in. This podcast is the home of the long emergency, and listeners know that we're in for some interesting times ahead. I suppose you've asked yourself, am I prepared? I know you've heard that you have to own precious metals in your portfolio, whether physically in your possession or in an IRA or stored out of the country somewhere. And it's imperative that you work with a company that advises you on and manages your gold and silver. ICA has been an industry leader since 1972. Your ICA advisor will get you set up correctly and keep you informed about when to make a move, when to add ounces, and even assist you with an exit strategy when markets change. Call 1-800-525-9556 for a free portfolio review. That's 1-800-525-9556. Or go to McIlvaney.com/Kunstler to request information. And McIlvaney is spelled McIlvaney. Speaking of finance, markets, and money, today I'll be talking with frequent guest David Collum, the Betty R. Miller Professor of Chemistry at Cornell University, who's become a popular presence on the internet commenting on the financial system and related predicaments of our time. He's also been involved in the campus culture wars, and he's not too shy to talk about it. Dave is a live wire and lots of fun, and here's my conversation with David Collum. So, Dave, I always like to catch up with you a few times a year, and you've got a very interesting presence on the web as a commentator. And in the years since the crash of 08, which is almost a decade now, we've been in a sort of supernatural period of calm. And yet to casual observers like maybe you and me, there's so much that seems to be out of balance, and it makes me nervous. How about you?
Oh, yeah. There's a million angles we go at. What I've been thinking a lot about lately is the question of what does overvaluation of assets mean? You've heard the phrase, I'm sure, that, you know, debt is consumption pulled forward and saving is deferred consumption. I realize that overvaluation is appreciation pulled forward and undervaluation is deferred appreciation. And I actually tweeted that and got a lot of responses. And then I asked, you know, has anyone else thought this? And so I actually started Googling it, and I found a 2013 post that happens to be the only one happens to be by me at Zero Hedge. So apparently I'd forgotten, I'd already thought it. here's why it helps me, because I'm in a very large cash position. And what it tells me is once you're overvalued, any further gains is like altitude on a plane. At some point, you're going to give it all back. And you're going to give it back by a variety of ways that you and I have talked about, whether it's a, you know, some sort of reset of the prices or inflation or a slow grinding growth in the GDP. But so I've been paying attention to the fact that the markets and many, many asset classes appear to be twofold overvalued. So you say, well, okay, so people are up for a beating, right? That's virtually a guarantee. But then you got pension funds that are underfunded. You've got pensioners who have saved nothing, and you take 50% away from endowments and pension funds, you've got a catastrophe on your hands. So that's what I've been focusing on a lot lately, is valuations.
Well, somewhere in there for me is the idea that the things that we attach value to are often chimerical or hallucinated, shall we say, that they're not real, like, for example, currencies around the world. You know, the value that we attach to currencies are what we seem to believe that they are at any given moment, but there's really no way to establish it. And based on what you and I know about our problems with growth and debt servicing, you know, one might easily imagine that the currencies themselves are, which we vested all this value in, are really not what they seem to be.
Certainly, especially given the central bankers around the globe seem to think it is in their job description to hurt their currencies. So there's something like $18 trillion worth of negative interest rate yielding debt globally. Negative interest rate yielding debt is actually in itself a non-free market, nonsensical phenomenon. No one in any other world would accept negative interest rates because you would just go to cash, right? But they're preventing it from go to cash, and so they kind of got us boxed in. So, yes, I think the currencies are short-lived. There have been something like 5,000 paper currencies over the years, and there's currently about, 30 or 40 maybe left. And the rest are all, you know, tombstones. And so presumably the ones that currently exist will become that too. A lot of people don't realize that the U.S. has essentially defaulted on its currency. I think it's three times in its short 200-year history. And so, yeah, currencies are going to come and go, and so is ours. And the authorities seem determined to do it to somehow solve our problems, which maybe that's how you solve the previously mentioned problem I was talking about. But, yeah, it seems ethereal. You've got companies like Snapchat, which is a company whose major user, his core demographic, is something like 17-year-old kids who don't have any income and don't have any jobs and possibly very few prospects. Snapchat's valued at $35 billion. Someone explained to me that. How do you put a price of $35 billion on a company that gives away its service to impoverished clients, right?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's really a stunning one, right? Mm-hmm. So it'll come down. And it is coming.
Well, it has, hasn't it, since its IPO?
Oh, yeah.
Considerably.
And in fact, it looks like, you know, sockpuppets.com or whatever.
Yeah, right. It's already been turned into kind of a market joke.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a lot of jabber about the cashless economy. And, you know, we see evidence of it, of experiments in Europe. Sweden appears to be attempting to go as cashless as possible. Of course, there's that experiment in India where they basically just got rid of 80% of the cash in the system. I don't really see how that works in India because so many of the just transactions for services have to be in cash because these millions upon millions of extremely poor people don't have bank accounts and they don't have credit cards. But I also don't really see it in the United States because it's going to piss off a lot of people. And the people in the United States are already pretty pissed off. And there are a lot of loose small arms in America where, you know, people can cause an awful lot of mischief if they are pissed off. How do you think the cashless economy is going to go over in the USA?
India was a disaster zone. You understated how bad it was, right? I mean, the entire Indian economy essentially shut down. And it was almost the akin by saying, look, no big bills are allowed. And by the way, their big bills were something the equivalent of $20 bills. They were not
tens and 20s.
Yeah, they sounded like large numbers because they were in Indian currency. They did it overnight, and it would sort of be the equivalent of saying that you must use electric cars as of tomorrow. And you go, well, but I don't have one. You go, well, okay, you've got a problem then. And so India, I think, hopefully was not, but I bet it was a beta test of some kind where it wasn't some Looney Tunes Indian who made this call. It was a much bigger sort of global banking system that decided that was the call that should be made.
By the way, it's really funny that they picked India because, you know, India is the leading culture where when bad things happen, you just have to sort of suck it up according to your, you know, belief system. So that's kind of a funny choice there, isn't it?
Oh, well, actually, it's a good choice because that means you can do the experiment without revolution, right?
Yeah, but the experiment still, you know, stands a chance of working or failing, and it doesn't look like it's working that well. I mean, I don't understand how these rickshaw drivers and, you know, day laborers and other people doing the scut work in India, are going to be paid. And I don't see how that they've worked that out.
Here's the question. So you can outlaw Indian currency. How do you stop Indians from using that currency? So there's this story, I can't remember what book I read it in, where some guy wrote a check in some banana republic. And just by chance, he came across this check maybe a year later. Maybe he got deposited. I don't know. But the check he had written, being a Western check by a credible guy, had been used as currency. And all over the check were written all sorts of notes to give it to other people. And his check followed this incredible trail. It was being used as a currency.
Well, this happened before the 20th century all the time. And in America, especially between the Revolution and the year 1900, people would pass around all kinds of, you know, promissory notes and bills of lading and warehouse receipts and really anything they could attach some actual value to. And they would use that as currency. So it's not terribly surprising. That's what people do, right?
Right. And that's where paper currency came from, right? They started out as gold deposit receipts. And then people said, well, I don't actually need the gold. Just give me your receipt. And therefore, I now have your gold. And that's where the idea of paper currency backed by gold came from.
Exactly.
So back to the digital world. I mean, I see so many problems with going fully digital. I see problems that already exist.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, the millennials love using their phone.
Right.
To do everything. I can tell you from personal experience dealing with my son, I hope he doesn't listen to this broadcast, I don't think the millennials have a clue what's going on in their bank account. The idea of balancing their checkbook is getting lost. The idea of monitoring their flows are getting lost. They're just my phone took it. My phone gave it back. I'm okay.
Well, forgive me for getting too personal, but do you refill your kid's bank account all the time? So does he have that expectation that there will be money coming in?
Complicated story, because he did a major shift where he went from a job, moved to Denver, hoping to get a job. And so the answer is yes, I enabled that. And what I'll tell you is that the big hairy ass bet that I made was that I could somehow carry him across that void. And he's a well-educated kid. So there was this hope that I would get him across that void to a really good job. And he was going to go to school and do a little skiing, and I was okay with all that. And it turns out that he just had his first day of work in a new job that's a stupendous opportunity. And so it worked for me.
Oh, good.
There's parents across the globe who have children who were not doing well. And if you said to the parents, look, how much would you be willing to write a check for to get that young adult kid of yours into a stable career? And there's parents who say, look, it would be a six-digit paycheck. I'll write any amount. Just get him there, get her there, because it's not working. Uh-huh. And so the idea that you know, spending money to get your kid to a stable adulthood, which, you know, in years past, I don't think my parents worried about that. But, you know, I think it's a problem right now. The millennials are getting beat up and they're beating themselves up. And, you know, there's a lot of things going on here. But bottom line is the money I spent, which was more than I really wanted to, got him to a very, very good sort of job that he's proud of, I'm proud of. It's a good job.
How about some of the other problems you perceive in the digital economy, like maybe the fact that, you know, algorithms can destroy your personal finances, and that, you know, the electricity can go out, and, you know, digital money depends on the electricity being okay 24/7 all the time, 365 days a year. So what about some of those things?
Geez, you know, there've been so many mishaps in the digital world. To say that somehow digital money is safe and cash-based money is unsafe is not. So, you know, there's this apocryphal story of the Zimbabwe who lost $100 million due to a digital raid. And, you know, some of your readers, I'm sure, know about this one, but that's a ton of money for Zimbabwe, right? That's a GDP number right there. And what happened was, you say, well, but that's Zimbabwe, they're a banana republic. Well, the money was hacked out of the New York Fed. Uh-huh. And the Fed said, hey, not our problem. And Zimbabwe just lost the money. The raid came in through the Fed.
Uh-huh.
So if you think your account, I had a cash card, which I like to use. I wasn't thinking. I didn't realize it was a debit card. And I had a vast amount of money in the account it was attached to. And the guy at the bank said, you ought to move that money over to this other account to insulate it from your debit card. I go, right. And I lost it. Right. Huh. So, I don't trust the digital world at all. It's filled with potholes. It's filled with hackers.
There was that Mt. Gox problem with Bitcoin, where I think something like $25 million, or was it that little? A fairly substantial sum of money just vanished from the thing and put Mt. Gox out of business. Mt. Gox was a Bitcoin transaction app or station or place or thing. And that was the end of them.
Yeah, and it showed the vulnerability of a currency that people thought was invincible. The Bitcoin fans think Bitcoin's the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Well, it's real popular in China at the moment, but, you know, that has to do with some other things.
I own an expensive house, and I'm not a big spender. So you say, well, isn't that squandering your money? And the answer is no, because A, I'm so underexposed to assets at this point in my life. I'm a 61-year-old boomer. I'm something like 55% cash, real short-term debt cash, spread over 12 banking-like institutions of all shapes and sizes. The house is sitting on Cayuga Lake. It's an unbelievable house. And I go, well, I will expose myself to the vicissitudes of real estate for that chunk of money. But it's tangible, right? There's an abstraction to the price, but it's still a tangible. It's never going to zero. And in fact, I read something recently where they talked about Cubans who got exiled, brought with them the deeds to their land. And when Cuba frees up, they'll go back and they'll say, that's my land, and they'll get it back.
Well, that has happened before. It happened in Germany.
Of a story of the bank, that this Monte Paschi in Italy, where the bank lasted something like, you know, 800 years. And someone was asked, how did your family wealth be retained for 800 years? I think this is Rickards who told the story. And they said, we split our money a third, a third, a third. I think it was real estate, fine art, and gold. Yeah. And they said, that has kept us from failing. And even things like real estate. So the horde comes in, takes your land, you hang onto the deed, they get pushed back out, you bring your deed back, your family has its land back.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so very long term, this family kept their wealth.
Well, there are going to be certain kinds of real estate in the United States that probably aren't going to do too well. A lot of them are, you know, bound up in big, complex investments like real estate investment trusts, which are kind of like index funds for real estate. And, you know, a lot of that stuff is in commercial real estate, namely malls, strip malls, and other junk buildings that don't have a whole lot of prospect for keeping their value.
Those are sort of barely tangibles is the problem. Yeah, the strip malls are all going to go to hell. I mean, that's happening. You know that, right?
Sure.
I mean, you've been writing about that.
I haven't been investing in them.
Before we met, yes. And those are distressed assets that are never coming back. Those will get bulldozed.
And yet they're an example of the kind of thing that people are already kind of stuck in. And I don't think that they're aware of how fragile these things are.
If they were in it, they're not aware.
I mean, the REITs are still there, still humming, you know, still trading and still being bought up.
Yeah, I wouldn't own a REIT. For one thing, because a REIT's a bit of a derivative anyways, right?
Sure.
You don't own it. If I'm going to buy real estate, I'm going to buy the real estate. I could imagine some point in the future where all hell is broken loose and the system has collapsed and there really are distressed assets. REITs and they're buying up stuff for pennies on the dollar. I could go back into one of those, but I sure as hell wouldn't do it until we had reached the 1933 level of pain and suffering.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, speaking of that kind of an incident, I want to talk to you about the current business cycle scene. You know, you'd think from looking at the charts of the last 9 years, you know, from 2008 on, maybe 2009 on, that the powers that be, to use a kind of cliched term, have accomplished a long wished for goal, which was to disable the business cycle. You know, and we see that in, you know, the stock markets only go up from now on. And can this really work? Are they just building greater tensions in a system that will eventually express themselves catastrophically?
I got in a fight last night that went on for about an hour on Twitter. You should get on Twitter. It's a great place to waste huge amounts of time. I posted a post. So the Fed has been essentially at zero for almost a decade now, right? So this is emergency levels. This is an economy on life support with a steroid drip, right? And what's interesting is the business cycle looks like it's turning down now. If you watch things like car sales and stuff, everything's turning down. And what's interesting is the Fed just now seems beginning to wake up to the idea that they got to get some interest rate back into their Fed funds rate, or they'll have no ammo. Now, I don't even buy the idea that I want the Fed using ammo, but to the extent they do buy the idea, then if your interest rates are sitting essentially at zero, you got no ammo. You are at 50,000 feet and you're out of gas.
Let's just stop for a minute and explain that to listeners, because what it really means is that the main tool that the Federal Reserve thinks that it has to control the economy is lowering interest rates in an emergency, but they can't lower them when they're already near zero. So they've got to raise them in order to lower them. That's the essential dynamic, right?
That's exactly right. And there's this thing called the zero bound, zero limit bound, where once rates get to zero and you're out of luck, they say that that's when all hell breaks loose. And Bernanke comes along and says, oh, no. My favorite phrase is he says, we have lots of tools at the Fed. And I go, boy, I agree with that part. and so they go into the QE and the negative interest rates that they're doing in Europe and stuff like that. That's where I think the damage to the system goes into a supernova phase. Mm-hmm. That's where things like insurance companies start defaulting and failing and pensions fail and people go broke. And the system, the entire economic system is based on the notion that you can borrow at X and put that money to work and get Y and skim some off. That's what business owners do. That's what everyone does. And if you break that part, you break the system. I think they have.
Pensions are already on the brink anyway.
Oh, they're way past the brink. Pensions are flatlined. Many, many of them. State of Illinois, 40% funded. You will never get that back. That'll be a federal bailout. But, at some point the Fed starts failing, right? The state of Kentucky's pensions, 21% funded. So we funded an entire generation of boomers with free promises, hoping that we'd find the money when we got there. And it's not here now.
Yeah, CalPERS not looking too good either.
Well, CalPERS actually formally doesn't have, I think if I understand this correctly, your listeners may say, oh, this guy's an idiot. I think CalPERS is not in charge of covering the cost or in charge of managing it. And so CalPERS is saying, look, this is not our problem. We're just in charge of holding the money and doing the things we do. You guys haven't funded it. So I don't think CalPERS is on the hook for the money. I think CalPERS is the messenger. Yeah. I'd love to have someone send me an email to tell me that's wrong, if that is, but
I don't know. My understanding of it is that one way or another, they're simply not going to be able to pay out the pensions that they're obligated to pay out. So,
across the country, across the globe, I believe we're in a mathematically untenable situation. Yes. In fact, I did a podcast yesterday, a big week for a podcast. And the guy said, well, how do we get out of it? I said, we don't. This is the person who's been told you got 3 months to live. You can go through all sorts of intellectual gymnastics to try to figure out how to get out of it, but you're not gonna.
Right? What podcast was that, by the way?
It's a guy in Israel. God, I can't remember the name. This is embarrassing. Something Future Trends or something. It's an Israeli guy who just asked me to do it.
Okay. Well, I want to get back to QE for a moment. Quantitative easing, or money printing in plain English, or creating money digitally that didn't exist before. And, you mentioned QE being a very perilous and damaging dynamic in and of itself. We've already had QE 1, 2, and 3. They seem to produce apparently no damage that people can really point to. And yet there's a sense that if they turn around and do that again, that's going to be the real bad one. Why do you suppose that the first three didn't absolutely wreck the system?
There's a good analogy here, several of them actually. One is if you look at Weimar Germany, one of the things the Fed focuses on, the fact that inflation is low, and they talk about low velocity of money, which basically means you can have a ton of money in the system, but if it's not moving fast enough, it doesn't elicit inflation. Weimar Germany, the velocity of money sort of head to the basement twice before hyperinflation blew out the system, and eventually leading to World War II, right? That was clearly part of the march to World War II.
Yes, sure.
And so I think the Feds are totally missing that idea. There was an interesting post by a guy named Ronald Stoefferle. I think he's German.
Yeah, I followed him. He's around the web. He pops up a lot.
I think he's one of the new era gold bugs who actually isn't just squealing about the end of the world, but rather is analyzing. He showed a bar graph that showed the three big inflations of the 20th century in the U.S. So these were not hyperinflations, which are very rare. I don't remember the dates, but one of them was certainly in the 70s. And he showed next to them in the bar graph the inflation rate from 2 years prior. And this inflation rate was staggeringly tame.
Mm-hmm.
So what he says is basically this is the equivalent of someone pulling slowly on the trigger with a gun aimed at your forehead. Okay. And the next minute you get a bullet through the brain, right? And so inflation comes. And then it reminded me years ago playing golf with an economist at Cornell. We were talking about inflation. He says it comes out unexpectedly. And I didn't quite know why, but I just logged in that little nugget in my skull and said, keep that in the back of your head. And now it's coming out useful.
It's like that old Hemingway quote where he said, he's talking about a guy who went bust and he said, how did it happen? And he said, slowly and then all at once.
I didn't know that was Hemingway, but that quote does it, right? That's in chemistry or in physics, that's what's called a phase change.
Yeah.
Right? That all of a sudden it goes from one state to another and you think it should be a continuous incremental thing, but it just changes. It's the avalanche. It's here you have block of ice and the temperature keeps warming and it's still a block of ice. Then it gets above freezing and all of a sudden the block of ice is a puddle and you go, I didn't see that coming, right? I didn't realize that thing could become a puddle.
Yeah. Right? Well, so, we had an interesting double whammy last week. I expect there to be some major consequences coming out of it, but so far we haven't really seen anything. And I'm talking about the interest rate hike by the Fed and the end of the debt ceiling holiday that was negotiated back, I think, in 2012 between Speaker of the House John Boehner and President Obama. And they agreed to sort of suspend the debt ceiling until 2 years out and basically sort of shoving it in the closet so that we didn't have to talk about it until Obama was out of office. And now Obama's out of office and it's demanding to be talked about.
Yeah, so let me talk about the first one first. And that's something I was heading towards a few minutes ago and never quite got there. And that is I put out a tweet which showed the downturn. I think the graph was auto sales, used car sales. Now, used car market is way overpriced. Anyone who's tried to buy a used car, you'll find that what you can buy makes no sense. You'll get a three-year-old car at a 25% discount. Anyone who understands the life expectancy of a car knows you don't give up the best 3 years and get 25%. The reason it exists that way is because they've created a massively effective credit system to pump up the price of the used car sales, right?
Right. 7-year loans for used cars.
So when we were young punks, which is back before cars were invented, but after that, to buy a used car, you wrote a check. And so used cars were cheap because the availability of an honest buyer was limiting. And so what I showed a plot of was the used car sales turning down. And it looks, and there's a number of things. There's corporate debt turning down. So it looks like the indicator saying we're about to go into the downswing of a cycle. And the tweet that I posted was basically said the Fed has waited so long to try to renormalize these rates to get them to a place where they can then wiggle a little bit. They waited so long that they missed it. And now they're hiking right into the teeth of a slowdown. And I think I probably used the word meatball a couple of times. One of Wall Street hedge fund guys, we really got into it. And it was clear we were not connecting. But he kept saying, I can't believe you think that. And it just went on and on. And the bottom line was, I was saying, look, the Fed is hiking while the indicators are now turning south. And it's because 3 years ago when they had opportunities, they got spooked. So China devalued the yuan a little bit, and the Fed said, we can't do it. And then Brexit, we can't do it. They kept passing on opportunities because, to put it in the bluntest of terms, they're a bunch of cowards. They didn't want to cause pain on their watch, in my opinion.
Sure.
They deferred tough decisions, so they just let debt accrue.
You know, there's a certain amount of chatter out there that the Fed is doing it because they wouldn't mind actually sinking Trump in a sea of financial trouble. What do you think of that idea?
I don't know. I have no trouble endorsing wild-eyed conspiracy theories. You know, I draw the line at fake moon landings and things like that, and Almanite aliens. But I'm willing to submit to the notion that men and women of wealth and power conspire to do dastardly things. I think this one is probably simpler than that. And the other thing is that'll backfire. They want to hump Trump. They should wait a year or two so that they do it right into the teeth of a reelection. Now, if they think they can knock him right out of the presidency, then yeah, you have a ball, but I don't think they can. And so, and by the way, Reagan, who got elected right into a nasty ass recession, and by his reelection, it was morning in America, right? So
yeah.
Trump is the guy who should be hoping for a big downturn, and he might be acting in a way to trigger it. I give that more credence, actually, is that Trump is attempting to trigger a downturn.
Well, Reagan, of course, was coming in under completely opposite financial circumstances. You know, he had a comparatively much lower national debt. The stock markets were way down in value, and interest rates were way, way historically high and had nowhere to go but down, really. So it's exactly the opposite for Trump. I kind of want to ask you, what do you make of Trump's first couple of months in office and how he's doing out there? I was not a Trump voter. I didn't vote for Hillary either. Just saying.
Well, so I became a Trump voter. People will laugh at this one, although it's not yet done. I decided Trump would not be militaristic. I just saw his budget. His budget would argue to the contrary.
Yeah, and all the generals that he's installed in his government.
Yeah, but it's conceivable all of that is to prevent having to bomb people. Time will tell, because don't forget, he's a big showman, right? So the question is are we over his presidency going to stop bombing Syria and stop bombing Yemen and stop killing millions of people, in my opinion? I mean, real war crime levels. And I'm a right-wing Republican, so this is not some – I'm not some trans whatever who doesn't like anything like that. I think we need to be strong. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to stop bombing countries for stupid-ass reasons. I talked to a guy in the Pentagon who used to be a – Trident submarine captain, and I said, what's our Syrian policy? Why? He couldn't give me a hint. He said, I don't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
The Israeli guy yesterday, he said, I don't know why you guys are attacking Syria. I don't know why you guys are over here. So I was hoping Trump wouldn't do that. His first couple of months is interesting. He clearly he's not a schmoozer, right? He's a schmoozer at some level, but he seems
very isolated.
Yeah, well, but don't forget, he's being isolated by powerful forces. So I personally don't believe what I read now, and it's debilitating. So you'll read about Trump's connections to Russia, and then you'll read something that says there's no evidence of his connections to Russia. Then the next day you'll read about his connections to Russia. I don't know what to make of it, except for the fact that I do know that we have to have connections to Russia. And I think picking on Putin's a stupid idea. And so anyone who thinks that Trump shouldn't be cozying up to Putin to make sense of this world, I think that person is dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there was a very interesting moment in the House hearing yesterday about Russia interfering in the U.S. election. When one of the House members introduced this idea that Trump has said that he's being bugged or wiretapped by the FBI, and FBI Director Comey said, oh, no, you know, absolutely not. We haven't done any bugging. But then FBI Director Comey said that the FBI has been investigating Trump since August, before the election. And I don't quite get how they are doing an investigation without some kind of electronic surveillance. So that didn't really add up for me.
All you have to do is read about J. Edgar Hoover and read about the CIA. I personally would find it difficult to imagine that our various intelligence agencies and the FBI aren't monitoring our own people at this point. I think you have to be kind of a fool to think that are not doing this. The NSA's got us dead to rights. And to think that, oh, yeah, but it's against the law to monitor Trump, how you swallow that model is beyond me.
Yeah, and, you know, the release of the WikiLeaks Vault 7 documents about 2 weeks ago pretty much established what appears to be the fact that the intelligence agencies can spoof anything they want on the internet and confuse any set of digital footprints emanating from any, you know, hacker to make it look like anybody they choose is doing the hacking. So it seems to be absolutely unreliable now to be able to even assign that sort of guilt to a particular party when the security agencies themselves are claiming that they know.
So I read an article the other day about some guy from East Germany who was a Russian propagandist, and he described in detail how they do it and what they do and blah, 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 and all the tricks they did. And I got the end of the article, and I go, that was A, interesting, and B, quite possibly put out by us.
Right? Right. You do. Who knows?
My son sends me a videotape of a North Korean woman, very young. She looks about 12. She's something like 24, who escaped North Korea. And she talked about how horrible North Korea was. Now, the first thing I noticed was her prose, her presentation. The knowledge required to give the speech told me it was not written by a North Korean. It was written by an American or a Westerner in the very least. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is I'm watching this thinking, does the appearance of something like this tell me we're about to go against North Korea?
Yeah,
because that's the kind of thing we're going to start to see if we're going to demonize North Korea if we have to go against them. And I'm watching this. I'm going, this is bullshit. This is not – I don't know who wrote her speech, but it was not her, because she is an ignorant North Korean without access to any of the information that she used in her speech to tell us how horrible North Korea is.
Well, the casual observer would have to say it's pretty easy to demonize North Korea at this point, given what we're seeing in the news. But you know, according to what you're saying, what we're seeing in the news can be very misleading. So do you think that it's legitimate to demonize North Korea? They seem pretty crazy.
No, I think it is legitimate. What I think is when you start to see it regularly, it's telling you we're about to do something.
Yeah, okay, that I get. That's an interesting signal.
It's the pulse of the demonization. No, I think North Korea is awful. I think Kim Jong-un, if we could off him, I'd have no trouble with that.
Yeah.
And we knock off far lesser tyrants than him.
Yeah. I wonder why we can't get the job done.
But it's when you start seeing these stories that are starting to play on the public psyche, you say, oh, now they're going to do something.
Yeah. Well, the rest of the world looks remarkably unstable, looking back over a fairly long lifetime of geopolitics. We haven't seen Europe in so much political disorder in my lifetime. I wonder what you think of this with, you know, elections coming up in France. And by the way, there's a story out today on the web that the French newspaper Figaro is giving Le Pen a big edge suddenly in their so-called secret polling. And Theresa May is going to be starting the Brexit procedure next month. Turkey has been threatening a new flood of refugees, sending a new flood over to Europe. Plus, they're having a diplomatic battle with Holland and Germany. What do you think of all that action over there? And how does it relate to the idea of the European Union and its survival?
So I think the refugee crisis, which in my opinion was caused by us, and again, I'm not anti-American. I just have not understood why we keep going at Syria constantly. But I think the refugee crisis maybe even likely prove to be a monumentally important historic moment.
Well, it's like the opposite of, you know, the Moors were thrown out of Spain in the 15th century. And this is the opposite. They're now sort of reinvading.
Right. And they're reinvading by being pushed into us. And pushed into Europe. And they're attempting to push them here, too. So who's pushing is a great question. Fascinating question to me is the European leaders like Angela Merkel and various heads of European states are defending the receiving of massive numbers of young male-dominated refugees against all political logic to me, against the voters, against everything. Why is Merkel signing off on 1.5 million refugees is a good thing for Germany. Why is she doing that? Do you have any sense?
The only story that I hear that has any meaning is the idea that the Germans are so overwhelmed with guilt for what they did in and around World War II that they find themselves in this moral quandary. But that seems to be kind of a flimsy story for, you know, people having a policy that is so much not in their interest.
Right. I agree with that. Someone else said that. Maybe you and I were chatting about it or something, but someone else said exactly that. That's a lot of guilt to be holding for a long time. Yeah. I think the Northern Europeans, like the Swedes, suffer from congenital putty-headed liberalism. and I think they consider themselves to be the superpower of benevolence or superpower of openness. And so they accepted them, you know, with open arms, teddy bears, you name it, and it's turning into a disaster. Mm-hmm. And they won't even admit it. So now here's this country with a bunch of very benign people that sort of approximates a bunch of hobbits, best I can tell. and they've let the dark forces into their country, and they're absolutely unprepared to handle it.
Yeah,
and I don't understand what happens next. I think this is why people who oppose refugees are getting elected, because the people are getting very frustrated by it.
Yeah, and something's going to give there.
Paris, right? Paris is turning into an inferno. And mm-hmm. I think was Paris triggered by some Middle Eastern guy who got taken into custody and then died or something?
He was supposedly raped by the police with a baton. And, right. It's very possible that happened, for sure.
Yeah, it is very possible it happened. But what's also true is that, you know, you can't blow up something without the dynamite, right?
Uh-huh.
And so that's the match. But, for example, if some guy, you know, if some guy in Westchester County got raped by the cops with a baton, what you wouldn't get is riots in the streets. You would get people pulling out the stops to straighten out the cops.
Yeah. That's true.
And so the powder keg is the vast number of unemployed, angry young males who left their country because they got the hell bombed out of them, and who generally don't like Western society, best I can tell. And so in many ways, I'm very sympathetic to their anger.
Uh-huh.
Now Europe's got the problem, right?
Does it eventually affect the European Union?
I think it breaks it up.
Okay. Well, that's pretty definitive. Mohamed El Arian was on the web this morning. He's the former partner of bond king Bill Gross. And he said in today's Guardian that Trump must convert surging U.S. confidence into growth. Can we convert confidence into growth? Is that spinning gold out of straw? What is that? What is that? How does that work?
Well, so I keep hearing this argument about how the Fed's supposed to fix things. Then people say, no, the government's supposed to fix things. I go, what about both step aside and let, you know, equilibrium get attained? Right. I'm a big believer in free markets. I'm a big believer that if you don't get in everyone's way, they'll kind of sort it out. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Ron Paul fan, slowly becoming a Rand Paul fan because I think he's growing up. And I'm a big believer that the government shouldn't do things that they don't have to do. So you have to have a military. I think you have to have, you know, interstate highways. I'm well aware of your view that they'll eventually become obsolete by it. But as long as we're driving cars across the country, we got to have them.
Oh, sure. I understand what you're saying.
And so those are rational roles of government, but they've now become the whole ballgame. They're like the referees who are now carrying the football themselves. So I don't see a great solution to this. I don't see a way out of this. I think we've got to have our come to Jesus moment. I've been getting darker lately because I think this business cycle is ending, and I'm rather optimistic in a twisted sort of way that now we're going to find out what's wrong again.
Well, you know, I have a fairly severe view of the American future, which I tried to lay out in my World Made by Hand novels. And, you know, that involved imagining a pretty severe reorganization of daily life in our country. And, in the sense that, you know, the whole corporate armature of life would not be present, and there would be a lot of missing institutions, and a lot of things wouldn't be working too well, and people would be thrown back locally on their own resources. If you were going to reorganize the macro American scene of U.S. life, even just as an imaginative exercise, how would it work for you, given the conditions we face, and including especially the capital and resource scarcities that are coming up?
Oh, I don't know how to handle the resource scarcities. Again, I've been reading this stuff not as long as you, but over a decade. I think ultimately the problem is I think the system has to sort itself out. Darwinian selection pressure culls the herd, right, of the weak. Mm-hmm. And I think that complex systems cannot be invented. So I think that trying to create something from a blueprint that's really, really complicated doesn't work. It's, you know, even the microchip wasn't invented. It evolved, yeah. Right?
Well, there's that principle of emergence is, you know, it really rules that.
Right. So the microchip represents the success after thousands and thousands of failures. And the problem is we've got a system now that seems to abhor failure. So we've got a Federal Reserve that literally Federal Reserve governors have said, we can't afford to have a recession. I go, well, you're going to get one, you idiot. Right? You always get them. That's like saying we can't afford to hit a bump in the road. Well, they exist. So get over that thought process. And it's the fear of recessions and the fear of corrective mechanisms and the fear of having it hung on them causes the Fed to keep jumping in. I think anyone who thinks somehow government, this big bloated mess of Republicans and Democrats brawling, and it's gotten so toxic. Anyone who thinks that the solution is going to come out of those clowns is dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some sense, this is one of the reasons why I'm still watching Trump. I admit he's looking wackier by the day sometimes. But if he can somehow manage to shrink government's footprint, admittedly at great cost to people who will be very unhappy. But you know who your readers should listen to, by the way? A guy named Jonathan Haidt.
Oh, yeah. I've been following him.
He's fantastic.
He's an NYU professor, and he's actually been writing principally about political correctness and the whole phenomenon of the end of free speech on campus. And he understands it very clearly.
Oh, and he can articulate it like no one I've ever seen. So it's Haidt. You go on YouTube. There's a great discussion by Jonathan Haidt and a guy named Nick Clegg. There's also a great seminar at Duke that he gave.
Yeah, Duke University. It's a lecture, I think, that he did.
Oh, it's a beautiful lecture. And he's got this way of disarming his critics with this alliteration that and he talks about very difficult issues. One of the things he said that just caught me was he's talking about the various states having the say. I am happy to let Mississippi decide things for Mississippi and let New York decide things for New York. We are different universes in many ways, right? Mm-hmm. Now, sure. As he put it, he said, the problem is that people will be appalled in one state what another state is doing.
Mm-hmm.
It will bother them. And the problem is the sanctimonious crowd, which there's more and more of every day, will find that just intolerable. That we can't let Mississippi ban abortion. Well, as far as I'm actually concerned, Mississippi can ban abortion, and you can move the hell out of Mississippi if you don't like it. Because if they want to be some banana republic, third world country down there and let unwed mothers rule, I don't think it's mine to stop them.
Uh-huh.
I live in a state where you can get abortion if I believe in abortion, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And as long as that option exists, I'm okay with it. I think if Indiana, you know, go out into the sort of the flyover states, if there's a state out there that wants to make kids pray in school, I don't agree, but I don't care either.
Well, Jonathan Haidt is very clear about regarding the current PC social justice warrior phenomenon as a religious movement. I view it a little bit differently. To me, it seems like a racket. And I sometimes refer to our activities in the USA as having turned into a matrix of rackets. And by racket, I mean, you know, the expectation that you're going to maximize your benefits or profits without really delivering anything to the people who, you know, you're getting it from. And that's sort of how this is working in, the social justice PC Black Lives Matters matrix, where people want to extract as maximum benefit for either bygone or imagined problems pertaining to their, you know, their victim status. And I'm a little surprised that, especially that the people running the universities haven't gotten sick of that. And you're over at Cornell. I'm wondering what you're seeing now, you know, in the spring semester of 17 with the PC scene.
You know, it's interesting. First of all, I don't think you and Jonathan Haidt disagree in the sense that I think you're looking at the same elephant from the opposite ends.
Sure.
One of you gets the bad end. And I think Haidt just doesn't go near the racket issue. I think what you're talking about is actually that there are powerful forces with, even for that matter, profit motive and acquiring power behind the PC movement. I think that's true. I think that the kids who are fighting the fight on the campuses don't know this. I don't think they realize how much they are being used as soldiers or pawns in this great battle.
By the way, it's not just power or profit. What they're really trying to get is brownie points and social status for nothing. You know.
Yeah, I think that's their motivation.
Yeah. And that's easy to understand because they're kids, you know.
Well, not just that, but some of them are in groups that haven't done particularly well through history, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a gay male or gay female, you weren't treated well. I think we're doing much better now. My concern, and I've actually expressed this to both gay students and black students, so I'm not afraid to engage. I don't do it in big numbers. My concern is that it's become so extreme. It's become so distorted, where, you know, a faculty member can be thrown in the hoosegow, you know, in the penalty box for blowing a pronoun, right?
Yeah, they can ruin you financially.
And they can make a mess of your existence just for an honest mistake. You know, when I hear some old white male use the word gal, I cringe a little because I know it's not cool. But I also say, but that's where that guy came from. To the extent that I worry about these activists, I worry that they're overplaying their hand and that they're going to take a bunch of people who would be sympathetic, right? A bunch of people who are not homophobes or not racist, and they're going to get them to the point where they're going to say, please just shut up. And they're going to lose that crowd if they're not careful. And so they're going to send them scurrying to the other team and saying, I've had enough. I do not want to hear any more about this. You are a student at Yale, at Princeton, at Harvard. You are not as deprived of great opportunity as you're pretending to be.
Exactly.
Right? These are not kids sitting in the hood saying we don't have opportunity. These are kids at Yale saying our life is just terrible. And when we were young, the protesters were protesting about terrible things happening in Vietnam and terrible things happening in the inner city and stuff like that. This particular group seems to protest about themselves.
Yes, good, very good point. So, but you haven't had any major blow-ups this semester.
At least one of our deans thinks we've just been lucky.
Uh-huh.
I could be the proximate trigger of one, for all we know. Maybe this interview will go viral and trigger something. I certainly don't do these podcasts without risk.
Yeah.
If I'm afraid, 61-year-old, you know, department chair with a pretty much blemished free record, if he's afraid to speak, we have a much, much bigger problem, which, by the way, we do because most people are afraid to speak.
Uh-huh. I'm sure that they are. I don't teach at a college. I sometimes go onto the campuses. I'm very impressed with the fear level that I see in the faculty.
Yeah. And then there's some who I think are just idiots, right? I think there's faculty. And I think there's some who are so afraid to speak that administrators who I'm willing to call them cowards. The word coward is coming up in a lot in my discussions. The problems I see that are not being solved, invariably, I find someone who I can point to and say, it's cowardice that you are not stepping up and at least trying to deal with the problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good point.
The administrators who are afraid to stand up to a 0.05% of the population who are making a lot of noise, I think they ought to listen to them. I think they ought to process. But in the end, they got to get it right. And they're not getting it right. They're taking paths that are either part of their own personal agenda, which makes them repugnant to me at some level, or they're taking paths that they just know will be safer, right? That mm-hmm. the majority is not going to cream them. The minority, the heckling veto that's going on, that they could hurt them. So I just think there's fear. And maybe I should be sympathetic to those who are afraid.
Well, Dave, any final thoughts on where we're at in the spring of 2017 now?
Well, we kind of hit them, but I do think we're about to hit a downturn. And part of my thesis has been, so years ago, I formulated a model. Let's go back to markets for starters. But you know that markets wag the dog, right? If markets cut in half, social structure is going to go down the tubes, too.
Uh-huh.
I formulate this notion of what a secular bear market is, a bear market that really washes out excess. And it came from a bunch of guys who said, look, there's three phases to a secular bear market. The first one is a flesh wound. You get knocked on your butt, but you dust yourself off. You say, that's okay. I'm a long-term investor. That would be 2000 to 2002, three. The second one hurts. That's the one where you go, oh, Christ, I've been down this path now. I know what this feels like. We just got whacked again. Are you kidding me? That's 2007 to 2009. And then there's the third one. And the third one is the one that rips your soul out of you. And it's the one that gets you to say, never again am I going to go there. Never again are they going to dupe me. It's going to be the one that makes you want to hang people in the streets. A fourth turning kind of a moment. And I think that one's coming. And I think the next recession will usher it in. And I think the authorities who try to save the system at all costs may very well fail this time. And we will find that there are consequences to propping up a termite infested structure without cleaning out the termites.
Mm-hmm.
And the people I argue with about who think we're fine, I say, look, I have an end game. I have an exit strategy to my worldview, and that is I believe the next recession is going to beat the tar out of us. And if it doesn't, I'm willing to say I was wrong. And if it does, I'm willing to then act accordingly. And I hope I have the guts to act wisely in that next recession.
Well, I think you've summed it up very well, what we might call the coming sucking chest wound of finance in America. And
right.
I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. It's always great to have you. And I'll look forward to checking in with you again, maybe, halfway through the year.
That's great.
We will ride again.